About 1960-62, they passed the omnibus bill in Minnesota, making history a natural resource, and it allotted some money to develop the sites throughout the state. And so with another few other people, we had the site bought by the State Historical Society and restored, because there are over 2,000 Indian carvings in this pink quartz site, outcropping. And surveyors and geologists have said that this quartzite ridge could be as deep as a quarter of a mile in some places. No one has come up and given me any information on why this sand was that deep, and it is just sand with rust that has colored it to make it pink, iron oxide. And the silicates have formed it, and then of course the pressure from the metamorphic process. The glacier striations are over the rock, and that was over 10,000 years ago. And then these carvings are carved through. There are none of them that showed any signs that any glacier marks were through the carving, so we could not date them pre-glacier, but they're quite 3000 BC, the first ones that they believe. But while I was working up there, I was there 12 years and spent many hours all alone out there on the ridge, and I began to realize that prairie was older than the petroglyphs. Some of the plants are believed to be as old as the redwood trees. And when the last glacier receded, then the tundra, the small plants, start growing, and then as it gets warmer and warmer, then the other plants move in. And all of the prairie plants are perennials. They restore themselves year after year. Part of the plant dies, and it provides cover for the ground, and it also feeds the plant itself. You've heard the naturalists tell about birds, about animals that will stake out a section of the territory that they need to survive. And some way, the prairie grasses, and they're all bunch grasses, have set up a status quo that they have just the one bunch of grass, and all the seeds that fall do not grow like annuals do, where they just grow and grow and crowd each other out. And in between the grass plants are the forbs, or the flowers. Some of them have bulbs, some have large tap roots that go down. And these grasses, the prairie grasses, have fine roots that spread out to protect the soil and to keep the moisture in, and the dead grass and the plants that die cover it. And we burn out during a drought, very bad drought, and all the fields and the ditches were brown. We went up on a piece of prairie that had not been burnt, and there was moisture underneath yet, because the prairie had saved it, and the plants would only use the amount of moisture that was available for all of them. It was the best social system that I've ever seen, because they all share alike. The only time we have any plants that get large out there would be if there was a badger hole someplace where the soil was disturbed. The grass was not there to keep the status quo. So then the sunflowers and the goldenrod would grow large, and then that would set off a little off the balance. We restored 47 acres of this 80 because it was cultivated, and the thistles were so bad, the weed inspectors were breathing down our necks all the time. So we seeded it to grass that we imported from Kansas, Nebraska. The university and the Nature Conservancy do not like this practice, but I could not see myself and a couple of others about like me going out and gathering enough grass seed to plant on 47 acres of land and not have the annuals take over and destroy it, and the thistles, of course, would get it. But as the years went by and this prairie grass established itself, the thistles have become weaker and weaker, so they can handle that. The only thing that has come along to disturb the prairie is the Hungarian brome, which was imported to bind ditches and waterways. And the brome has underground roots like quack, and they spread out and they not only choke out the prairie plants, but they also have a toxic substance that they give off to kill plants so that they can survive themselves. And that is the danger we have out there. And this year the Nature Conservancy is going to burn it. And I learned a new term this summer when they were out there surveying it and setting up their burn schedule. They have to burn the brome when it's in boot, and I had never heard that term before, but that means that they want to burn it just before the head comes out, while the head is still just ready to come out of the stalk. Then that's when the roots are the weakest and the plant has all of its energy making the seed, and then they burn at that time, and then it weakens the plant so that whatever prairie plants are left will be able to come up and survive. And maybe as I go along, I will add more about the prairie. This one I can't recognize, so I'll go to the next one. This is the way the land lays, and of course down there in this area we have square miles. If you ever heard of them around here, you wouldn't. But anyway, that's the cross section of the road, mile section, the mile road going each way. And the, now wait till I get this thing going here. Oh, there we are. The petroglyph rock is right there. And this is the field that we restored, this part and around the end. And this part here is the virgin prairie. And this outcropping of rock comes here, there's a there, goes across that way. It goes across here and it's this way, and then there's some rock outcropping here. And the this quartzite ridge starts in Wisconsin and it comes out near New Ulm, the Minnesota River. It's quarried there and it's quarried at Jasper over toward Pipestone. And right here there is some area that looks like it could have been quarried, and this is where the catlinite could be. Now Pipestone has the same type of rock, and they have catlinite, which is a soft, it's a clay that hardens after they take it quarry it. The Indians are the only ones at Pipestone that can quarry it. And it is conceivable that there would be strata of catlinite in this, but nobody's ever quarried this to find out, although they have a pit there that they crushed it for the highway. But there hasn't been an awful lot of research done here in this area.
So which is the site here?
The site that I'm talking about is right there.
Okay.
The photograph isn't very good. It was a friend of mine took it.
Are you in that photograph anywhere for us?
Huh? I couldn't get up there. I would have if I had a chance to. I don't know if this is... We have a...
Just keep pressing.
Oh, okay.
Ooh.
Too far. Oh, there it is. Then the spring, one of the first things that comes, there's the rock, and this is the area before the site was bought by the state. People would drive up here and drive all over this rock. It was a great Sunday adventure for young people to go up there or take their horses up there, but mostly their cars. And we have the chokecherries to the left there, and the few plum brush on the top on there. That's all the trees are there. And of course, this is in the spring, so you can see the grass isn't very tall. And also, right here is where the cars had driven it down all the years, and this picture was taken a long time ago, about 68. So you can see that a lot of changes have been made. And they started it out calling it the Cottonwood County Petroglyphs. And I didn't like that because the people that owned the land were named Jeffers, and the state bought the land from them. And Jeffers is much easier to put on a sign, Jeffers Petroglyphs, than saying Cottonwood County Petroglyphs if you write that down all the time. So I went out and proved to them that there were a few other petroglyphs outside of this site, so then they changed it to the Jeffers petroglyphs. There are more ways to skin a cat, you know. And the first flower that, well, let's see what I can do with this one. Now, I'm not that good at close-ups, but that's the pasque flower, and that's the first flower that blooms in the spring, and that's all the dead grass and the accumulation, and a lot of that is brome, so it makes a heavier growth than some of the prairie grasses do. I'll be pressing the wrong one here pretty quick. And this is the choke cherry blossoms. And the violets. But that's the way they come in the spring. Very little ones, and the grass is starting to grow. Most of the grass, the earliest grass, is the cold season grass, which is your Kentucky bluegrass and your brome. It comes up early. I shouldn't say this, but I always was tempted, if I could have had my own druthers out there, I would have used Roundup on some of that brome. Now there's a view of the rock again with your choke cherry blossoms. And the little pussy toes that grow down, now that's up pretty close, but they are all over in the lower areas where there's more moisture, where the runoff on the rock is, because on the ground below, any of you that are farmers, when they plowed the ground, it was the depth of a furrow, and then it would be the quartzite all underneath. And you always wondered how they could raise a crop down there, but the moisture goes down from the rock, and the rock seems to hold it. So that's how it grows down below. This is the prairie smoke. When this gets in seed, it looks like the old man's whiskers and the little flowers on the side. Now this is in the spring, before the grass has gotten really going. The little buttercup. This is a piece of a rock that's exposed, some of it there. The petroglyphs are there. But this is just another piece. You wonder if the prairie chickens didn't do their booming in the spring out on top of one of these out.
Now, is some of this virgin prairie?
That 33 acres around it is virgin, has not been disturbed.
Is this virgin here?
Yeah, this is virgin. I don't have pictures of the reseeding that we did. This is again a little buttercup showing the nearness of the rock, and also there are a number of outcroppings of rock, but they don't have petroglyphs on all of them. I don't know why they would have picked certain ones. And also, there are some of the petroglyphs on the rock that are down under the dirt. So we wonder what is below. And also, it had to be something very hard that they chipped this rock out with, because that rock has a hardness of about 7 on a scale of 1 to 10, and that is hard. And they had to have a lot of skill to do it. And we wonder what is down underneath this dirt. Man, I don't have very good pictures, do I? That is the ground. I have other pictures at home, but I didn't find.
You could go a little further on the focus.
No, I guess they're bigger than what I thought. But this is a ground plum, another one of the, it's a vetch. And it has fruit on it, and the animals like it. This is the lousewort, another one that, some years this is really like this, and some years you don't see it very much. So it always depends on how much moisture you have. And each year, season is always different. You're going to see a different plants responding. And when you start out in the spring, most of them are bulbs. And they've stored up their energy over winter. And they start out, and then when they stop blooming, the next growth is a little higher, and by the time fall comes, you have the goldenrod and the sunflowers, the tall, so that each season it gets taller and taller. This is our parking space, and you can see there, if this is taken in the fall, and all of that brownish colored is the big blue stem, or turkey foot they call it, blue joint is another word for it, and that is the tall prairie grass. And this other up here, the whiter, is brome. And we have a parking space back there, and That didn't have that when I first started out. We came a long ways. That was in one of the Indians from up, but the Dakota Indians up at Morton. That's again showing the flowers in the background. I guess I just took them sometimes because it always changed. That's the liatris, which also doesn't always have a heavy bloom, but that's a very beautiful pink flower. And that's the petroglyph site there. Some people up on it. We have a lot of visitors that come there, roam over the rock. Some days it's really beautiful, and then when it's about 100 degrees and the wind is blowing from the southwest, it can be hot as you know what.
We were out there on a day like that.
You were?
Ugly, yeah.
Oh, it's murder.
And the rock just sort of boils you. You just kind of...
Friday's gone.
You went this way?
Yeah.
Yeah, the shelter is just, it's just supposed to be a shelter. They didn't intend to keep anything up there, but I sort of prevailed on them to keep, at least to close it in so the birds wouldn't come in. You can't keep the snakes and the mice out, but you can keep the birds out. And the thing that always bothers us are the satellites. They brought those, first it was some plywood ones they brought down from the city, some old ones, they moved them down, one for each. And we painted them down. Yeah.
You probably have to tell them what
satellites. Oh, they don't know what satellites are. They move them out.
Southern Minnesota.
Yeah, construction jobs, they always have to move them out.
That's the brand satellite.
And then they come out afterwards with an aqua. Plastic one, you've seen those. They're horrible looking. So they painted
like
them. They painted them brown. they painted them brown now, so that they at least they don't stick out like a sore thumb. That building there was a building that we had on our farm, and we moved it out there before the shelter was built, and I used that for a center for visitors and handing out literature and stuff. But afterwards, we moved it off of there. See which button am I pressing here now. Again, your liatris. Oh, you can see the satellites better now. Now later in the fall, you have the sunflowers. We have crushed rock around the outside to keep the grass and things from growing through there. We put plastic underneath it. And the inside, they have the exhibits. And they even have some rock now that the children can pound on, so they won't go out and do it out on the rock itself.
Down here.
Again, more of the someone had said that the of course the compass plant, and this is not, these are sunflowers, but the compass plant will follow the sun. And people will come out there and say, oh yes, these plants will all follow the sun, and that's not the truth. These plants follow the wind. And if the wind is from one direction, then they'll all be facing the opposite. And then when there's a period of time between when the wind shifts, there'll be a calm, about like the tide when it changes. And then they'll all be standing up straight, and then they'll go the other way. So I get a picture of them when they're all facing the way that I want the picture. There the grasses are getting taller. You can walk between the grasses and put your foot between one clump and the other. And they're not like walking through annuals. Again, this goldenrods. There's about 8 species of goldenrod out there.
They use it for dyeing, don't they?
Yes, and they...
They dye wool and stuff like that.
There's a number of plants that they use for dyeing things like that. See, we put the floor in there of these logs. They cut them off and put them down there, and then we put the stone between them. And children can't resist getting down there with their hands, and so about every time it gets a little too bad, you got to get a broom and sweep off all those logs. And that goes just great until spring thaw came and the water came in and they all floated up and landed up on top of the sand. They've given them up now. They have something else in there. The lady that came in got tired of that. There you can see the big blue stem. That's my granddaughter. And the reason I have that, because we burn. And when they burn, wait, I get there. See, this is the ridge that we, the line along where they burnt. And you have to cut a road, or not a road, but a space through there, so that when you burn, you can use a backpack of water and you use a torch, and you can wet it down so that you can keep the fire from going where you don't want it to go. And the part that is tall is the part that we burnt. And then the big blue stem will go to seed. But if you don't burn for a couple of years, there's too much dead stuff on the ground, and the warm season grasses just don't come up soon enough to make it. And so its burning is important. And of course now the brome has covered it. And last summer I went out to visit it when the Nature Conservancy came down, and I pushed the panic button and called headquarters and said, you know, you're losing your prairie. They're about at least a third of it. It was covered with brome. How much of it had choked the roots out, I wouldn't know. But so now they've agreed to do the burning. But you see, the State Historical Society is geared for history and archaeology, but they don't know much about prairies. And this is one, the only one they really have is what's surrounding this rock. And we're 150 miles out of the cities, and I'm down there and there by myself, so they just don't pay too much attention to it. So if you don't make a loud noise, well, you don't get anything.
How much of it do they burn?
About a half they're planning to burn this year.
Half.
They came out this fall and mowed a breakthrough, and but they have to remove the fence. You remember there's a fence around there?
Mm-hmm.
And they said they have to remove the fence first, because if they don't, somebody could get trapped in that fire. Now that stuff can go real fast. And I set up a burn one time, and I wanted to get all the fire break burnt first and protect the building. And I had torches. We put rags on iron rods and soaked them in kerosene. And everybody was anxious to get going, so they went down to the south fence and started the fire. And they started it too fast before I had got all the backfiring done. And it makes its own wind, the fire does. And it just rolled up there in smoke with the wind, and I almost got asphyxiated because it drifted over onto where I was, and I had to get out of there. And of course, I was inside the fence. And so you have to make a big, and I remember one time we burnt, and a couple of guys came in, and they were very, they were very derelict looking, you know. They just stopped in to use the satellites. And they didn't come into the shelter, they went right to the satellite, and the wind shifted. And oh, did they come out of there fast. This was the grass where I had the lady that visited the site was pulling the flowers up, and of course you're not supposed to remove anything and not supposed to destroy, the same as here in the village here and in the woods. You aren't supposed to take anything that's disturb it. This lady was out pulling up the plants, and it was on a long day, and I was very tired. It's about time for us to close. And I asked her if she was going to plant a garden, and she said, oh yeah, she thought she would. She had a handful of these plants. And I said, well, that's all right, but just don't disturb the bull snakes. And boy, she made a beeline back to the road. We do have big bull snakes. Every time they burn, why, the neighbors get a lot of them. This is following a burn. It burns off everything. Now, that is a very good burn. If you burn against the wind, you'll get a good burn. It'll burn all the trash off. The ashes will go in, and the plants, in 1 week, the plants have started to come back, and they will bloom. And I did an herbarium, and some of the plants I got were after a burn. And during a season of a plant, whether it's your milkweed or whatever, if they have their natural enemies, there's always an insect that uses the plant. And of course, if you aren't out there to beat them to it, well, you don't get a good specimen. But when the we burnt and all of the plants that were delayed, they didn't have any insect damage. I was able to get really good plants because the insect season was past, and so then the plant came later. And of course, when they see the date on it, and a biologist would say, well, that's, or a botanist would say, that that's out of season. Well, it was out of season because the burn had delayed them, but they all came back and did their thing.
What time of the year do you burn?
Well, we burned in the spring, but again, you should burn when the brome is in boot, but I didn't know about that. We just burnt when the weather was good. If it's raining or something, or bad weather, or the wind is in the wrong direction, the neighbors complain, it isn't easy to get a good day. And then, of course, now, I wouldn't be able to go out there, or neither would it, and none of us would, because they have to bring crews out from the Nature Conservancy now. The laws and the regulations and everything are up, so if we can't get a crew out there. And what was surprising to me was that the legislation was already in force, the appropriation was already made to provide for this burn, but nobody had done anything about it for now, this last 2 or 3 years. And all they had to do was just set up the program. It was all in force, but nobody'd gotten into it until I rang the panic button. Now here again, you can see the grass is starting to come, and this is just a couple weeks after the burn, and the on the left side, and they made the fire break there. This is all brome along the front edge. It didn't burn clear up there because there wasn't enough dead stuff to do it. And this wasn't an awfully good burn area here, because you can see that the grass isn't burned off good. But when they burn with the wind, the fire just skims over the top. And when you see how fast that fire will move, you can imagine back when this was all prairie, and the pioneers came out here, and they would get caught. They'd have to be near a river or something just to protect themselves, because that fire would be fierce. And there would be no groves of trees. You see, you have up here the groves. They were not here at the time when the pioneers came across. In Minnesota, we have the woods to the east, and then there is what they call a peninsula area, where you have a mixture of grass and trees. And then out here in the southwest, it's all grass. The only trees would maybe around a river or near a lake. And when the pioneers came through the woods, they got along pretty good. But when they got out and had to hit this prairie without wood and have to hunt for water, It set them back for a year or two until they began to adapt to it, and then figured out ways to get across it.
The fires would happen naturally every
year? Yes, by lightning. I don't know where I was reading just the other day that they were talked about the static, and I realized, you know, began to think of something, because I burnt a ditch one time. And it was one of these days, you know, when your hair feels like it's going to stand on end, you know, everybody's edgy, and the little twigs would snap and set the fire a foot or two ahead of me. And that fire was moving so fast it scared the daylights out of me. Mm-hmm. And I beat it back to the house and got some water and some wet rugs and went out there and stopped it, because all I had was just the width of a road ditch, but the railroad track was down ahead of me. And it would have headed into town. And I can see why you wouldn't be able to stop a fire. And when you hear about the Santa Ana winds out there in California, it's the same thing. The static is so high that a slightest little spark would set off a fire. Hmm. Now this is the grass that's come up now. See, this is fall. And you can see the... Now here again, you see that this is the big blue stem is blooming, and here the same area, only this had not been burnt, and this is not seeding. And that was as high as my head. When I have a print made off of that. I thought I had a slide of it, but I didn't. Here's the sunflowers all facing their backs to the wind. And this is, I better get going here, I'll be all day talking here. You can see the lichen that's growing over this rock, and the lichen breaks down the rock. And the bedding planes, these are very, very old. This is not all breaking off now. And when these bedding planes were laid down, when the it was a sea, and the water washed up and deposited the sand, and then whenever there was clay in the water, the clay would settle down and form, I say like putting flour in a cake pan. When you don't want the cake to stick, you put a little flour at the bottom of the pan. Well, that's what the clay did. And then the bedding planes would let go. I have one. What happened to my petroglyphs? There's a cornfield that was before we replanted, because that's our property line there. And this cornfield is now into reseeded into prairie grasses, and it's growing real good. And the neighbors would give a lot to have the hay off of there, where they've plowed up all their prairie and made it into, put it into alfalfa, which doesn't last an awful long time. And they said at first when we planted it that it wouldn't grow. And we had gone to the legislature to get the funding. I don't know, it's about $1,200 that they allotted to us to buy the seed and have the, it planted. And the weed inspectors out because we were supposed to cut the thistles. Well, we couldn't go out and disturb the plants. You couldn't see them, but they were supposed to be there. We needed the nurse crop, which we used was oats. We needed that to protect the ground. It was very, very dry that spring. And the neighbors had said, you're going to have to plow it up. You don't have anything there. Well, one of the Nature Conservancy people told us not to worry. The prairie grass seed does not come up and show any head until the roots have established. And I think it was 3 years before we saw any evidence, or very much evidence, of prairie grasses that were coming. And now they're very thick. This is just some of the rock. This is our first, what we did was use chalk to chalk in the things so we could take pictures of them. And this was the work we did before the state bought the site. That's my cousin and I. And we did a book on it, and I sent it to everybody I could think of, legislators, anybody that had any influence, and then the state finally bought the site. We had to persuade them that there was something there, because nobody believed it was there. You can see down there at the edge there, where that light coloring is where the dirt has washed away, where the seepage lichen hasn't gone. That's right. Now you can see the glacier striations and how deep that has been carved. And it took a lot of skill and a lot of work to chip out that and get it to flake out so that it would, you can see the little things. This is one of the deepest ones we have there. This is, again, where there's quite a bit of lichen. They're scattered over there. It's, people have gone in there and carved over the years, some of them back 30, 40 years. Sometimes people will come out and say, oh, I left my initials up here, and they go out looking for them. And I don't know if any of you heard of Sari Deans, but she was a Hungarian artist from New York who came out to do these for the Smithsonian. And she did these rubbings on big pieces of muslin and on sheets. And she showed me how to do that. And I did quite a few rubbings over the years myself. And it was quite a project, but it really took the prints good. This was in the fall. You can see the grass is tall. Wasn't a very good picture. I got two of those. This is the only profile that we have at the site. And the profile and the hand are the common. The hand you see everywhere where there are petroglyphs. But I don't know how many profile. That profile is not as old as some of these others at this end. And I swear that looks like it's upside down, but or I mean in reverse, but that isn't.
How big is it?
Well, that's a 12-inch ruler.
How old did they figure
it? This one isn't as old, but the others down at that end, that big sunburst that I showed you, they thought that was at least 3,000 BC.
Jeez.
But this profile is not considered to be that old, and it's different technique that they that they've carved it. You can tell.
Who did they think hit him?
The primitive people that came in, they wouldn't have any idea what tribes the first ones were, but the last ones would have been the Dakota Indians. But the first one.
B.C.?
Yeah.
Is there any speculation about what it meant to them to do this? Was this a
I wouldn't know that either, other than the fact that there's weapons and symbols and different, well, I'll go on and show you some of the others.
Florence, isn't this a long way? This is a long way from water, if I remember correctly.
Yeah, the Little Cottonwood River is right below there.
Oh,
about a half a mile. So they had to have been down there. And there is a bluff on that river that would have been conducive to killing the buffalo by spooking them, I would call it. They would rush them over the edge, and then they'd break their legs. And that was the way they could kill them. See, there's a lot of lichen on this area, and whenever we remove some dirt to expose the rest of a petroglyph, then that would be light colored because the lichen had not grown over it. And then, when they did the archaeological survey, we used varnish to fill in them so they could photograph them. But the varnish has worn out, but now they've started to do that again, because when you go out there, and if you're on a day when the sun isn't in the right direction or something, you can't see them, and it's a disappointment to you. And that's the only horse symbol that's there at the site. And this is a site of the Addle, and the animals, and the figure there could be a thunderbird. Nobody's come up with any, but you see this one up here now, that's an animal also with a little round thing in front of it. So it's difficult to understand just what the symbols were, and here's a hand again.
What's the addle-addle?
The addle-addle was a weapon that they used. Didn't we have one here the other night, a film that we showed?
Spear thrower?
Yeah, they used it for to lay the spear on, and then they would throw it, and it would give force. It would take the place of the bow. And they would get a great deal of force on that. And I think I've got some other pictures that are, you can see how involved. Now this again is a deeper one, and how involved this is. And here's another of the weapons again. I wouldn't have any idea what these mean. And I don't know how many of you have read the book Danikin's The Men from Outer Space, or whatever what name of that book was, but this one is the nearest to a totem pole. See the three heads? And there's the weapon, the addle-addle, that's on there. And this again, look at the ear things on here. Give a little credence to it, you know, if any people from outer space came in here. Well, the effigy effigy figures at Blythe on the mesa above by the Colorado River, they have them there 150 foot high effigies that have been scooped out the rock that's on top, and the patina that darkened the rock, and some primitive people have scooped them apart, so they made big lines, and it wasn't until they had an aerial photo of that area that they knew that those effigies were up there. Here's another one, a closer one of the... This is again the addle-addle across the body, the hands, the head's about too far up there. This is an effigy, and after I had photographed this, and then I have it varnished in for the archaeologist. And early one morning when the sun was just coming up, we found that there's a leg on that. See it? So I went, when I varnished it in, then I added that to it. There's an arrow there, and you can see the snake symbol across up there. But the small head and the heart in the center, and I don't know what these are. See it from there, and I could see it bigger, further back. And we scooped the dirt back here, and so that we could have more exposure on this. And here again, you can see the whole thing, and it's all about the same. The only thing that's different is this. This is sort of smoothed out in the rattlesnake symbol, but the rest of this symbol is all the same, so it's probably the same artist did it. You can see what the lichen is doing to our, someone thought this was a Phoenician sign. Somebody else thought it was a Chinese symbol. I don't know what it is, but it's very distinctive. And you can see there now, the dirt has been removed. There isn't any lichen on this rock because we scooped it back. And someday the archaeologists will go out there and dig down further and find out whether what weapons they, I don't mean weapons, what tools they use. They thought it could have been gabbro because gabbro was hard enough and it came from the Lake Superior area. Here again you can see the weapon on this buffalo. That piece there has been chipped out. You can see here too, a lot of people come in and they think they see figures. But that is leaching, the crack there, and the iron oxide has leached out at the cracks and left the lighter colored stone. I don't know what that figure is. Looks like somebody had a baby. Now this is an area that I scrubbed off with a brush because when the lichen is wet, it's soft. And I scrubbed it off because I knew there was something under there. And we came up with all of these buffalo figures here, and it looks like the record of a hunting scene. And the buffalo right there has a man at its head, and I wanted this one because there are weapons. You see the weapons in there, the atlatls, spears, and it's a really fantastic area that's there. I could scrub it off a lot more, but I didn't have that much ambition. When we got done with the survey, the archaeologist stayed about 2 weeks longer than he'd planned to stay there. And finally he said, enough already. We don't need any more. If we're ever going to find any more someday, we'll go back and do it in some future date.
That must have really been exciting.
It really was over the summer. And he surveyed it. Now they've got maps of it. But this is the buffalo that I use for my rubbings. And it's my favorite here. But I always figured that was, you know, the tail. But I think that's a break right there. I think that's the tail. But then it could have been a spear, but I'd prefer to think it's a spear. And this is the lightning, thunder, and there's a rabbit. And the next one is the thunderbird, which is facing the other way. And the reason that is it has no lichen on it was because before we had the site bought, and this was very disappointment to me because it was a teacher from a neighboring town brought the Boy Scouts out there, and it was years afterwards one of the scouts had grown up and came back to visit, told me what had happened. He had used cold cream to cover this figure up. And then had taken a plaster cast of it. Then he went away and he left the cold cream there, didn't clean it off, and the sun melted it and it went into the rock and stained it and left a very, it looks as though somebody had worked on it recently and it didn't. It's a very, very old figure. And also now you can see, I'm noticing it myself, that somebody has been chipped it to try to make it more visible when they wanted to take a picture of it. So people go out there and they do things, and you have to keep a watch on them all the time because we have what we call our pot hunters, people who always want something but they never try to be careful of what they're doing. Here's an overall view of this that you can see there. There's a broken arrow there, and somebody's carved their initials years and years ago, not knowing that there were any figures there at the time.
Florence, down the lower right-hand corner, it occurs to me that's sort of a leaf figure, but I think it's part of the weapon. It looks like a leaf to me with the vein down the middle.
Wait, where am I?
In the lower right-hand
corner. Next to the buffalo?
There?
That figure,
yeah.
Right.
Yeah, that's supposed to be thunder, the sky and...
That figure is very, very similar to a motif that's used out on the Northwest Indian. West Coast and old petroglyphs out of it.
What do they use? What's the symbol of? What does it mean?
That I'm not sure. I don't know, but I know it's repeated out there many, many times out on the coast.
Maybe it means something entirely different. Maybe it's a symbol of a god or something.
I don't know. It's strikingly similar, but it may be entirely different.
Oh, and another thing, the cracks on this rock have just a little bit of soil in them. This is bedrock. This is, doesn't have any soil down underneath it. And so a little soil gets in those cracks, and then a little plant will start, and it'll be in miniature. And maybe a plant that would normally be 18 inches tall might be 2 or 3 inches tall, depending on how much moisture and dew and things there was on this rock. But it would produce a bloom, even if it was in miniature. And some of the plants are just, now this is a bigger view of one of the sites, and there again is your standard atlatl figure. See the rock that balances, and this would be the atlatl, and then this is a handhold, I believe, and this is the balanced rock. And buffalo, and this down here is another large atlatl. Somebody thought it was the figure of Minnesota, but it's not. But down below this section now, somebody tried to remove those petroglyphs, and I don't know where they are. Somebody has them. Somebody has told us that they were taken out, but they didn't find it easy. They had to have been broken up, because you see, this down here is partly removed. The chairs weren't there, you'd see it. And see up there, somebody's carved their initials again. And the striations, and the dark stuff is seepage lichen. There's another one view of it. I had a hard time sorting these. That looks like the one I had before. Don't know what that figure was.
It does look like giving birth.
Yeah.
That one looks raised up rather than quite.
Well, I'm okay, then the film is backwards.
But it's not backwards.
Now the sun is going down one night. They used to come out there, and people would never go out and wait till dark before I could leave. Now we close at 5 o'clock or else.
Who discovered them?
The first one was Ted Lewis, who did a survey for what's the railroad magnate? The house is up in the cities.
Hill
commissioned it, and so he spent a number of years doing surveys across Minnesota and looking for burial mounds, and he recorded these and put them on tissue paper. And they're in the archives up at the Historical Society. And he reported those where I showed you the buffalo and the thunderbird. He had done those. And then a white man named White, did a thesis on it. And he did a few of them. And then after that, my cousin and I and some of the other people came out there. And then we had to photograph them and prove to people that we had them. Coax everybody we could to come out and see them. And then the Historical Society bought the site and fenced it, and now they're talking about building a big center there. They'll have to pipe in water. We had accomplished a great deal when we got the first electricity and telephone in. They had quite a time finding enough dirt to get it underground, and you certainly didn't want the post, and you couldn't have found a hole deep enough to put a post in anyway. But you don't want anything up there that's going to spoil the atmosphere. And I think that's the end of my presentation. If you want to ask any questions about the prairie, I might be able to answer.
When was the site bought?
About 1963 or 4. I can't be sure. I always have to go back and when it was burnt and when it was this and that. Uh-huh. But I know on the back of one of my slides I said 1968, so that must have been when I did the first ones.
Mm-hmm. And how long did you work at
this? I worked there 12 years.
Until what year?
When I was 65, about 11 years ago. They had some legislators out there, and they said that they would have a special bill passed in Congress to let me stay on past 65 if I wanted to. And I said, no, I was through. I had done I did the herbarium of over 200 plants, and I had accomplished what I wanted, and then it was becoming a burden. is tiring. Whenever this challenge is gone, and there's nothing to be accomplished, then it's the weather and everything got to me. Before that, it was always something I needed to do. I went to Morris University for 2 quarters and took taxonomy so I could do the herbarium. And that was my legacy to the Historical Society. I have one of my own, and I gave one to the site.
So the herbarium is there?
Yes. The botanist has my, the one from Nature Conservancy, the DNR one, Department of Natural Resources, wants the herbarium that I have, and I won't give it to them. And I'll give it to the State Historical Society, because it was mine, I paid for it, and I worked it, and I just decided that I'm not so crazy about the DNR. They're okay now. They're not as bad as they used to be. We used to knock heads once in a while. They would come out, and they were very officious. I won't say what I called them, but I called them a pompous, you know what. But anyway, they felt like they had authority, and they don't. The Historical Society owns it, and they have the authority to handle it. And one came out last summer and wanted to take a sample of a hybrid that I found out there. And if anybody ever names that plant, my name has got to be on it, because I'm on record as having found it. Because it's a hybrid between the endangered species of clover and another clover that we have up there. But he wanted to take some of the plant and take them back and test it. And the site manager wouldn't let him. And he said, we have authority over it. And she called me, and I said, he did not have authority. I said that unless you are endangering that species, then the DNR can come in and say that we are going to take over. But if you're not endangering it, then they have no authority whatsoever, and they don't like to be told that. But that's the way it was. And she's about as feisty as I was out there.
Exciting. So that's become a reference. That herbarium has become a reference for research on.
And they just, I put it on, the one for the site is on notebook size paper. And it's in these plastic envelopes, and it's sealed so that anybody can look at them. But if you know what it is in a university, the herbarium sheets are like this. They're large. And see, they could be damaged with anybody that doesn't know how to handle them, but bend them and they break the plants. The plants are glued on there, and then they're put in plastic. I put mine in plastic envelopes. But I made that one special, and I had to hunt for plants that were small enough to go on so you could get the root and the seed and the blossom and everything on there. And every once in a while, a bug will show up in there. So you got to take them down and have them fumigated, so that they protect him. That's how come the botanist has my herbarium. She took it up to the university to have it fumigated, and she didn't bring it back. And she's got it up to her place, and the first thing I do when I get home this spring is to get that thing back and give it to the State Historical Society so it's safely put someplace.
There's a little yellow pamphlet that Florence wrote about the herbarium and about prairie ecology, kind of from a spiritual perspective. It's a little yellow pamphlet that's on the reserve reading for anybody who's interested in the library.
Thanks a lot, Florence.
Yeah.
Very interesting.
This is great.